this opportunity to be with all of you this evening. Special gratitude to Vivek and your beautiful family for opening the doors of your wonderful home for all of us. And to Peter and Amy and Greg and everyone. I don't know what to say, but I'm going to say something anyway. Vivek was talking about how his father was a dentist. And he was dental, and you became transcendental. That means he transcended dental. But in May of last year, I was invited to speak at the HSBC Bank headquarters in Canary Wharf in London. It was very interesting. There was 800 bankers that gathered in this hall, and I was standing on the podium, and I said a little prayer. What am I supposed to say to these people? So I began my talk by just being honest. I said, I'm feeling very honored because here I am speaking at one of the greatest banks in the world to about 800 of the greatest bankers in the world. And myself, I have not had a bank account or signed a check since 1969. They looked at me like I was an alien from the most distant planet in the universe. Like, how could anyone survive without a bank account? But anyways, then I went on to speak. They wanted me to speak on unity in diversity. The idea was they had so many people of different nationalities and different races and religions, from so many ethnic groups working in their bank, and they wanted a lecture that would create a sort of harmony. And they gave me a garland like this, and I picked up the garland, and I said, this is unity and diversity. It's beautiful. If every flower in the garland was yellow, it wouldn't be so nice. But we have yellow and purple and pink, and it's not that the yellow flowers are fighting with the pink flowers, saying, you know, I should be on this garland and not you, and I'm better than you, and you're fragrant and I'm more fragrant. And all the flowers, because there's a thread between them, the diversity creates a very beautiful form of unity. And what is that thread? You don't see the thread in a garland. You only see the flowers. But without the thread, none of them could be together. And that's the internal wisdom of, you know, what really is it that binds people together? And there's a beautiful verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Vidya vinaya sampane brahmani gavi hastini suni chaiva swapakeja pandita samadarshana. Describes what is actual knowledge. Who is a pundit? Pundit means someone with wisdom. In the Bhagavad Gita, it doesn't define a pundit as someone who has accumulated large quantities of data on their brain. It's not about getting a bachelor's degree, master's degree, PhD. It's not about getting many followers or defeating people in debate. Actual knowledge, actual wisdom, according to the Gita, is the ability to see every living being with equal vision. Whether one is man or woman, black or white, red or yellow or brown or yellow, whether one is Hindu, Muslim, Jew, Christian, Jain, Sikh, Parsi, Zoroastrian, agnostic, atheist, whether one is from the East or the West, whether one is a human or an elephant or a cow or a dog or a cat, to understand that life is sacred. Mamaivam so jivaloke jivabhuta sanatana. This is a verse from Gita where Krishna is saying that every living being is part of me. Every living being is a spiritual spark, a part of God, the living force within us. Because if we try to create peace in this world simply on the basis of our physical conditions or our mental conditions, there's so many things that are just not similar. The peace process is usually negotiations, but it's very vulnerable. But if we build our relationships with each other on a foundation of what we actually really have in common, we're all alive. And who is it that's alive? This is the principle of the Gita, that it's the Atma. It's the spiritual force, the living force that within us. It's seeing through the eyes and hearing through the nose and touching through the skin, thinking through the brain, loving through the heart. Who is that me? What is the difference between a living body and a dead body? Consciousness. And it just, the Gita explains that that consciousness is like the driver in the automobile of this body. And when we understand who we really are on this spiritual level, then we transcend all sectarian considerations, because when we understand who we are, we actually understand who everyone is, beyond the conditionings of the physical and mental states. Wherever there's life, there is a sacred part of God. And to love God, you cannot not love anyone. You may not love what they do, but we love them because they're a part of God, they're a part of us. And that, according to the Gita, is knowledge. That is wisdom. And that's universal. In the Bible, Lord Jesus, he proclaimed, "What is the use if you gain the whole world if you lose your eternal soul?" And to build a foundation in our own lives, personally as well as collectively, on that basis, accessing the love of God from within and being instruments of compassion, God's compassion. That's actually the purpose of yoga, and it's the purpose of all religions, to love God and be an instrument of compassion. The first commandment in the Bible is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And Gita tells, Aham Bija Pratapita. Krishna says, I'm the father and mother of every living being. So what does that mean? Everyone is our neighbor. The testimony of loving God is not on the basis of how many quotations from scriptures we can cite. The testament of how we actually love God is how we love all our neighbors as our own self. Because we recognize the string may not be seen with our senses, but we recognize the string that's holding everything together. And then as a global society, we could actually be united. Bible also tells that if you build a house on shifting sand, then when the storm comes, it will all collapse. It may look beautiful. It may be 100 stories high, maybe made out of gold and silver and beautiful architecture. But when a storm comes, it's all going to crumble, whatever it's made out of, if it's built on sand. But if you build that house on solid rock, whether it's made out of straw or whether it's made out of precious metals, it will stand. And what this is referring to is the foundation of our life. If we have peace, if we have fulfillment that's coming from deep within our heart, due to our values, our integrity, our spiritual connections, then nothing in the world can actually disturb us. We deal with the situations, but we have a foundation to deal with them. In which case, stress makes us stronger if we have a strong foundation. If we have a weak foundation, stress could really, we may deal with it, but we could really be in anxiety and frustration, and we can compromise our integrity, our dignity, our moral principles, our values, everything, unless we have an inner fulfillment. That inner fulfillment is based on compassion, goodness, devotion. And that's a universal principle. And this is so much a need in the world today, is in our educational systems. Just a few months ago, I spoke at Cambridge University in England, and I told them that here I am, I'm speaking to graduate students at Cambridge University, and I actually only had one semester of a junior college. And I'm teaching you. God really does have a sense of humor. But our universities, our colleges are giving our youth incredible amounts of education with science and technology, engineering, and political sciences. And these are tools which are extremely powerful. But what the peace and fulfillment and quality of life and in this world is depending on is the values that people have these tools are embracing. It's like a knife. Is a knife good or bad? A knife is only good or bad according to whose hand it's in. If the knife is in the hands of a murderer, then it will kill someone for their money. If that same exact knife is in the hands of a surgeon, it will save a person's life. Everything is potentially spiritual or material, good or bad, according to who uses it, our values. It's like at our hospital, we have a hospice. And in Vrindavan, a holy place, we just built a hospice for people. Because people like to go there to die. So at hospices, there's morphine. So when I saw the morphine, I was thinking, a drug dealer will use the morphine to somehow or other destroy a young person's life by convincing him to take more and more and get addicted to it. A drug dealer will take morphine to cause people incredible pain by ruining their lives. And a hospice nurse will use the exact same morphine to relieve a person's pain and to help them to die with dignity. So whether it's knowledge, education, wealth, prestige, power, technology, science, all of these things are neutral. They could be used to pollute the world or cleanse the world. They could be used to exploit or to serve. I have quite a few friends who are in the Wall Street scene in New York, and you know, they like to tell me about the inside information. One person, a good friend of mine, just wrote a book called Conversations with Wall Street. He was a big Wall Street person, and some of the biggest companies he was relating to, and he interviewed the biggest people in these companies. He recorded them, and it's all in this book that's coming out. It's not only shocking, it's horrifying, the way some of these people think. To make money is the only value they have, and what the cost for other people are, it's irrelevant. Not everyone is like that, but there are big people like that. So what's critical is to give the people of the world, especially our children, with the education, you know, universal values, an actual spiritual foundation that they could build their occupations, their families, their character upon. And then with that thread of values, our differences, the diversity among us, could actually increase the beauty of life for the world. Some people, they, in the West especially, they very much attack India on the basis of the caste system. Recently, a girl came from America, and she was from Syracuse, New York. She was a yoga student, and she was at our temple. And very nice, she's in her mid-20s, married lady. And she went to some other place, and we were gonna take her, we built an eco-village about 2 hours out of Bombay, and she was like in a hotel, and she was walking down the stairs, and she slipped and broke her foot. So we took her to our Bhaktivedanta hospital, and they did an x-ray, and she had a broken foot. They had to put her in a cast. And I went up to see her, and I said, "Welcome to the Indian caste system." But I said, "Because it's on your lower foot, unfortunately, you're in a lower caste." But anyways, the origin of the caste system is Varnashram Dharma, which is just the opposite of something oppressive and suppressive. It's not based on birth. It's based on our natural inclinations and the qualities that we live by. Some people are intellectuals. Some people are administrators and politicians or military. Some people are in business and banking and trading. Some people are, you know, doing hard work. And it's not that one is higher than another, because the social body is like a human body. It's not that the head is saying to the legs that you are just a leg. I'm the head. And it's not that the leg is saying, "Why are you exploiting me?" And the leg is kicking the head. And it's not that the arms and the stomach are fighting. The head is like the intellectuals, the educators. The arms are like the administrators and the political people. The stomach is like the people who are in business and trade and farmers. And the legs are the people who are, you know, doing work, labor. Every society, whether you call it socialism, capitalism, communism, or any other ism, has all those divisions. And the idea is we're all one body. And every part of the body is working for the whole body. You know, the kidneys have a different shape and a different color than the lungs. And the eyes have a very different shape and color and inclination than the hands. But it's not that the parts of the body are, you know, egoistically trying to prove that I'm better than you or I deserve more than you. They're all working for the whole, like this garland. You know, when we actually understand this higher principle, we're all here for each other. We're all the children of God in one family. And this is what's crucial for people to have these values. So these are some thoughts. And I'm so happy to be here. And there's so many different kinds of people here tonight. We have Jitaraj, who's a, do you all know Jitaraj Ji? He's one of the most popular and empowered radio disc jockeys that I've ever met. Very extremely popular, charismatic. He plays music and he's, you know, just enlivening millions of people on the radio every day. And we have bankers and we have people in American government, counselor general, and school administrators, and bankers, and we have students and housewives, and I'm a little Swami, and we have Aparna, my very dear friend, daughter, sister, mother, everything. Her family, they make ships, cargo ships, in Africa. So people from different nationalities, different occupations. But if we have that common focus, that foundation of deeper insight into who we are and our relation with each other, based on our love for God, then we're actually united. Can I tell you one strange story? It's really strange. Or should we have questions? Would you rather do questions or a strange story? People are naturally inclined towards strange things. Well, I'm coming from a Jewish family. And some years ago, I was sitting with about 1,000 people, maybe 2,000. There were 2,000 people in a place called Eka Chakra in Bengal. And we were taking people on a pilgrimage. And we were in this field at night. And myself and one of my dear friends, who's from Germany, were sitting under a tree on a stone platform. You know how they have circular stone platforms around trees in India sometimes? And all these 2,000 people were sitting in the field. And it was night. It was really dark, just some moonlight. And suddenly we saw all these people jumping up because a snake was slithering through the crowds and they were all kind of getting out of its way because they're usually poisonous. So we kind of just waited till the snake made his way through, and then we continued speaking. And we were talking about compassion. Compassion of my Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, who so much taught us these values that we're talking about. And my German friend explained how His father was an officer in the SS of the Nazi regime. Not a high-level officer, but like, you know, a little down. They didn't go after him after the war because he wasn't so high-placed. But, you know, he was, you know, under his commanding officers, he marched through Lithuania. He was helping to run concentration camps. And, you know, being a part of a machine, significant part, that was slaughtering Jews. And my family are Jews from Lithuania. And my father, my grandfather actually, he came just before World War I to America to escape the persecution of the Russian Tsar. And he sent, because he had no money, he didn't speak English, and somehow or other, the government sent him to Hammond, Indiana, which is just outside of Calumet City, which is just a few minutes from Chicago. And that's where my grandfather lived when he was in his 20s. And he was just selling potatoes with a little hand-pushed cart, and he was just trying to make it. And every cent beyond, you know, just the needs of his family, he was saving up to bring his brothers and sisters to America. And his whole savings, he sent over there. And somehow or other, it was just before World War II, his brothers, his sisters, their families, you know, who were my father's cousins, they all wanted a boat to Ellis Island in America. And who would be my grandfather's brother? He had a limp in his leg. So the US government rejected him. They didn't want people who couldn't, you know, do a lot for the country, I guess. So they sent him and his entire family back to Lithuania. And a few months later, the Nazis marched through and they were all slaughtered. So I'm coming from a family where most of the members were killed by the Nazis. This person sitting next to me is coming from a family who is killing my family. And do you know something? The two of us are most intimately loving best friends. Why? Because there's a thread behind all these different colors that holds us together. We love each other because we're humans, because we're part of God. I was just with him recently. I was in Germany with him. He comes to India with me. So yes, there's so many problems in this world based on problems with history. You know what? Some of our problem, people hate each other because of things that happened thousands of years ago. In the book I wrote, I cite an example where my best friend when I was 7 years old, his parents hated me because they said I was a Jew and I killed Jesus. And my friend told me, my parents hate you because you killed Jesus. I'm just 7 years old. I said, I didn't do it. He said, no, you did it because you're a Jew. He said, and even God hates you. That's what they told me. I was completely mortified. You know, I was this big. His parents were like, you know how big parents look when you're tiny. And I said, do you hate me? He said, no, you're my best friend, but when I grow up, I might hate you. He said, but I hope not. So, you know, people hate each other because of things that happened hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, whatever. That common thread that unites us is what's so crucial to focus on and to cultivate within ourselves. So that's the strange story. Anyone would like to ask questions? I'll be honored to try to answer. Please.
One expression I found was little mismatching was you wrote Ganges to Ganga. So if in the next edition in the new book you write Ganga, I'll be so happy. Because Ganga is Ganga, not Ganges. That's very small observation from a small man. And secondly, I've been reading some books about God and science. This time I was in Rishikesh at Dehradun Airport, I picked up a book called Codename God, by a Bengali scientist who came from extreme poverty and he became a billionaire by inventing laser technology, LASIK. And then he went wayward and then he came back and he was trying to relate science with God, and you know, then I lost him, I could not follow much of it. But then I read a lot of things about this God particle and you know, the consciousness and God and the quantum physics, all these things are going on. I read, but I don't follow. So there is any guidance you could give?
Well, I guess I have the free will to answer any part of your question I like, because it was a multi-faceted question. So the part I choose to answer is, in the West, no one knows what the Ganga is. Nobody knows Ganga in the West, except Indians. But Indians all know what the Ganges is. So that's why I chose that word. I'm sorry if I offended you, but that was my reasoning. And as far as the God particle and all of that, there are so many truths that we accept that are beyond intellectual and sensual perception. But we accept them. Just like a thought. Can you see a thought? Can you touch a thought? Can you, with your ears, hear a thought? Can you taste a thought or smell a thought? It's so subtle, it's totally imperceptible to the senses. But yet, thoughts are more powerful than avalanches. Yes? Depression is just based on thoughts. Elation is based on thoughts. Thoughts can conquer governments. Thoughts can invent spaceships and send people to other planets. But yet, you can't see a thought in a microscope. Love. We can see the manifestations of it. But we can't see love. Love is an emotion. Yes? So consciousness, we may not be able to, we can see the symptom of it, just like we can see the symptom of a thought and symptom of love by what's coming out of it. We can't see the thing with our senses. But where there's life, there's consciousness. How many of you have met Mahatma Gandhi? Or us from America, how many of us have actually met George Washington? We accept George Washington as president. We never met anybody that met him. We accept it because of books of people who knew him. And we just absolutely accept that he did exist. Some people may say, if you can't see him, if you never met him, if you never met anyone who directly met him, then he doesn't exist. But we accept it. Probably 90% of what we accept as true is totally beyond our sense perception. Something that has not experimentally been verified in a physical way. Yes? So I struggled with this myself, in a sense. Because growing up in the West, there is the concept that if you can't see it, if you can't prove it through experimental physical data, then we can't accept it. It's superstition, it's blind faith. But almost everything that we accept is like that. But all these great rishis and all these great sages and all these great avatars throughout history were the greatest people, most compassionate people, most disciplined people in the history of the world. Are they all just lying to us when they're saying that they see God and they feel God and there is a God? And some of the greatest, some of the worst things in the world have been done in the name of God. But also, so much of the greatest things in the history of the world has been done as an expression of love for God. So therefore, whether through quantum mechanics and different types of physics, if a person believes in God, then they're going to see God in their physics, and they're going to see God in their quantum mechanics, because he's there. And if somebody doesn't want to believe in God, they're going to see the same thing and use it to disprove the existence of God. This is my experience of what it's like living in the world we live in. But when we actually have that connection to that divine spirit of the love of God, then it's a reality beyond what we could feel and see with our eyes and hands. Does that answer your question? Yes, any other questions? I think you are all absorbed in pizza. Well, that's because you're the only one who's not eating pizza. By the way, this pizza is from the restaurant of our temple, and I don't like to take credit for anything, because ultimately I'm just an instrument of higher powers. But I arranged a pizza oven to be sent from Venice, Italy to our restaurant. So this pizza is cooked in a Venetian, authentic, imported pizza oven. Like to say anything? Yes.
I find in many discussions, many literature, that one is asked that you must, and I think in some way you have also written that you need a guru, Guruji, to reach the higher level of understanding of all the spiritual thoughts and everything. And in my very small way, you know, it's such a vast knowledge, I'm so little that I'm ashamed. We find that people then become very kind of blind follower faith in the guru. And then between God and guru, I find there may be there's something coming in. And I don't know how to express, but I've been seeing that. So any thoughts on that?
Something coming in, what do you mean?
You need a guru to have higher understanding, but people start following the guru so closely and blindly and start worshipping the guru in many places. And then what next? Does it stop there, or the guru is a god, God is guru, or how do we, you know, deal with that? My question properly, but
very, very excellently framed. Thank you. The Gita tells Tadvidi Pranipatena Pariprashnena Sevaya Upidekshantite Jnanam Jnananastatva Darshana. And the spirit of this verse is for any important subject in this world, we learn from a teacher. Just like if somebody comes, if you need open heart bypass surgery because it's diagnosed that you have arteries that are clogged in your heart, and someone comes up to you in the street and says, I'll do the surgery for me. You know, you give me the money and I'll do the surgery. Do you just say, all right? Naturally, you want to know, have you studied the proper books? And not just the books. The person says, I read the books. That's not enough. You want to know that they went to the universities, and university means that they learned the books from professors who learned from their professors, who learned from their professors, who learned from their professors, actually what the book's really saying and how to practically apply it to surgery. Yes? So we take those precautions for surgery. We don't just let anybody who says, I'm a doctor, do it. We want to know that they've understood from the proper medical books and they've learned it from experienced teachers. And we see that practically all the great athletes had their coaches and their trainers, and practically all the great musicians had their teachers or their inspirations that they learned from. Whether it's, you know, through formal education or whether it's through families or people that they've imbibed, you know, their knowledge from. Practically any serious subject, people have teachers who have authority and experience. And when it comes to spiritual subject, which is actually the highest, the deepest, and the most subtle subject, the tendency is anybody who says anything, it's all right. Any way I want to think about it is good. And that means that we're not really very serious. We're taking our spiritual education much less serious than any other type of education. Everything else we need is a protocol of teachers. But for spiritual, whatever I think is all right, whatever you think is all right, it should be taken serious. But according to the Vedas, the guru is not God. Because God is within every heart. But because the example is given like this, that originally our consciousness is pure. Originally, love of God is within all of us. But somehow or other, it's been forgotten. Like a drop of water, when it falls from the cloud, it's actually transparent and pure. But when it comes in contact with the dirt, it becomes muddy. It loses its transparency. When you filter the water, you simply bring it back to its natural state. So similarly, our consciousness, our nature is to love God and be pure and be humble and be compassionate. That's the nature of the Atma or the soul. But connected to material nature, this ego has been created. And the ego, so many attachments and so many desires and so many aversions, and that's what we see. So spirituality is simply meant to filter our consciousness and bring it back to its natural pure state. So that's what the guru is helping us do. The guru, we can't hear God in our heart, but if somebody has actually, you know, properly studied and properly practiced and actually has that connection, can help us to actually make that connection. And sometimes it is said, guru is not God, but God is coming through our guru to help us to come in contact with God. And proper gurus never asked us to have blind faith, but rather to have reasonable faith. To utilize our intelligence. And many of the greatest gurus and greatest disciples are people who had doubts and who had challenges, but who present the challenges and doubts with respect, with a desire not just to defeat, but to learn, to understand. And when we actually understand on that level, then we can have deep realizations. Blind faith, you cannot have deep realizations. It remains very superficial. Does that answer the question? I remember I was in Vrindavan, and someone asked my guru, I was sitting with him, someone asked him, are you the guru for the whole world? And there was just a few of us in the room, but I was really wondering how he was going to answer that question. Are you the guru for the whole, are you the guru for the whole world? And Srila Prabhupada looked down on the ground, he was sitting. He looked so humble. And he looked up and he said, I'm not anyone's guru. I'm everyone's servant. That's all. And when I heard that, I understood he's a guru. That's actually the qualification of a guru. Yes, please.
Speaking of spiritual education, I don't think I need that. speaking of spiritual education, I teach students, and I find that for a lot of the people I teach who are between the ages of 17 and 24, their attitude towards spiritual education borders on indifference. A lot of them take pride in the fact that they are agnostics. And the idea of a guru is very, very alien at this point in their life. What kind of a message do you bring to them to reconcile with the life that they're leading now? I mean, when we have a talk like this, I never, ever, ever see a teenager. And when we were growing up, we went to temples or churches because you were supposed to do that on a Sunday or a Thursday or a Friday, and we didn't challenge that notion. We are trying to do the same thing with this generation, and yet, they don't respond. So how does a guru try to spread the message that being spiritual is not uncool?
You are speaking like the mother of the universe. I see a tremendous revolution among the youth of India. really going very seriously to the roots of their spirituality. We have like youth groups at our temple, and once a month, there's usually 1,000, 1,200 boys that come, and then about 500 girls that come, who are completely surcharged with spiritual searching, and they're from 15 to 25. What I see is this, that these students of yours potentially could be really deep, saintly people. Because what sometimes, I'll tell you an example. A couple years ago, I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I was invited to a South Indian Hindu temple to give a speech, the Venkateshwar temple. After I gave my speech, they had really nice prasad. They had dahi rice and tamarind rice.
Sambar rice,
yes, yes, also. Beautiful. So afterward, the president of the temple and the trustees were giving me a tour. And we came to a very beautiful auditorium. And they were telling me about the auditorium. And they said every year they have a youth camp at this auditorium, where this one Swami from India comes and presents things to them. And most of these trustees are either doctors, or they're from, or they're PhD professors at Carnegie Mellon or the University of Pittsburgh. They're all from Andhra Pradesh. And I asked them a question. I said, these students come for this youth camp, you know, your children. Most of them have been born and raised in America. How are they adopting your culture and religion? Because, you know, you're all, they were like my age or older. I'm 61. So, you know, you were born and raised in India. But your children are born and raised here. How are they adapting to your culture? They said they will have nothing to do with any of our rituals. And most of their religion is about rituals, as far as the expression, the manifestation of their devotion. They said they want nothing to do with rituals. They want nothing to do with pujas. They don't want to do the mantras or the yantras or the tantras or the mudras or the pujas. They're just into studies and sports and socializing the American way. But then they said to me, but they ask us, why do you do this ritual? Why do you do this puja? Why do you do these mantra recitations? Why do you do these tantras and mantras and yantras and mudras and pujas? Why? And we have no answers for them. And the reason why we have no answers for them is when we grew up, none of us, and there was about 10 of them, the trustees, they said none of us ever asked these questions. Because the way we were brought up in India, you just do what your parents do, and you do what their parents did, and you did what their parents did, and your father and mother and your grandparents and great-grandparents, this is the generation, this is the culture, you just do what they do. So we have been following this religion and doing these mudras and pujas and rituals and reciting these scriptures since we're children, but we never asked why. So we have no answers for them. And then the president of the temple told me, he said, I think that our children are more advanced spiritually than us because they're asking the right questions that we never asked. We're just kind of surfing on the wave of what everybody else did. So my, I might offend people in the room by giving you my honest analysis, but what I see in India is so much of the religion is based on superstition and sentiment without a real scientific, philosophical understanding why. And when you grow up in the previous generations of India's culture, you were just taught not to question things, you just accept it. But now our children are exposed to Western education. You know, we're from Illinois and Michigan and Oklahoma, so we know American education, you're taught to challenge, you're taught to question, yes? And that's the educational system. It's very much like that. So now these kids, they want scientific, philosophical, practical evidence of things. And if their parents can't give it to them, they're not just going to accept it because you're supposed to do it. That means they've, in one sense, they're kind of out of the shell of the kind of the caste thing and the superstitious thing and the sentimental thing and accept it just because you're supposed to accept a thing. And they're out of that box. So now, if they actually hear the same thing, the same religion with the same mudras and pujas and yantras and tantras and mantras and everything else, if they hear it with a philosophical, scientific, practical explanation, then they accept it. And it's very, very deep and it's very profound. So potentially, these agnostic children could be the most powerful saintly people in your country. They just need to connect right. Does that make sense? And I've seen it with some of our own children and our among my god brothers and god sisters. It's very interesting. Because, you know, my guru came to America in 1965, so now it's 2012. He left this world in 1977, and he had thousands and thousands of followers. So, you know, I'm a Swami, so I don't have biological children. But most of the people who I'm very close with, they have children and grandchildren now. And I've just, you know, I'm kind of an observer. Because when you don't get too much involved in certain things, you just watch and see. And what I've seen, something very interesting, a social dynamic, this is my own observation, is the lot of the children in our own society who just kind of followed their parents, they're just really nice people and they're nice devotees. But then I see some people who followed when they were little kids, but then when they became teenagers, they questioned everything. And usually when they question everything, they kind of externally rejected it. And some of it got in, some of them started smoking marijuana and drinking alcohol and having boyfriends and having girlfriends and listening to rock and roll music and all of these things that the parents, you know, they gave it up long ago and they didn't want their children to do it. Huh? But now the children were rebelling. And there was, when children become teenagers, there's not much you can do about it. But it's those children, when they actually come to the conclusion that their religion is actually very good, they go so much deeper than the children that are just very nice and follow their whole lives. Because they kind of gave it up, And then on their own terms, with their own convictions, they accepted it again. And then it meant so much deeper. In the Bible, there's a beautiful verse where Lord Jesus says, be hot or cold, but if you're lukewarm, I spit you out. That's a Christian conception. But it's a universal conception, as everything Jesus said. That people who are just kind of lukewarm religious, they'd kind of just go on. But hot or cold, you know, sometimes it means you really question, and then you go deep. So I think the most important thing for these children is to somehow or other give them a chance to be exposed to their own culture in a way that is explained that's relative to who they are and what they are. Kaladesha Patra means according to the time and the place. If we don't explain according to time and place, it may be the truth, but it's just not relevant to them. We have to explain it in a way that's relevant to what they understand and how they understand things. It's almost like you can't speak to a person who only knows Italian in Swahili language. You have to speak Italian if you want to get through to them. You need a translator. So culturally, people understand things in certain ways. I was just last May, I think it was, or June. It was May. I gave a lecture at Princeton University. It was advertised as East Meets West. God, love, and spiritual activism from a Christian and Hindu perspective. It was at Richardson Hall. There was about 900 people that came, students and professors. And I was supposed to represent East. And the person representing West was named Dr. Cornell West. Have you heard of Cornell West? He's a very controversial professor. He's an incredible man. And he read my biography, The Journey Home, and I read his biography, Dr. West Living in Loving Out Loud. And so I kind of knew all about him and he knew all about me. So when we met, he's African American. And when we met, we were like old friends. It was quite amazing. And we spent a couple hours together. Then we went on the stage and we were giving this talk. But before, he was telling me, actually, everybody was thinking it was going to be a debate. But by the time, because we spent a couple hours together and made friends, by the time we got on stage, we walked on stage arm in arm, and we were best of friends, and we both agreed with everything else that everybody else said. And he was quoting me, and I was quoting him, and his students were. So that was real interfaith, actually, in a real sense. It was from the heart. We actually really respected and honored each other's devotion and faith. But he told me, because before he was a professor at Princeton, he was a professor at Yale, and before that he was a tenured professor at Harvard University. And he's revolutionary. He was called in by the president of Harvard University. He was one of the most popular professors there. He was called in by the president because he made a rap album. Do y'all know what rap music is? I don't really know what it is so much because I'm here in India, but you know, I think it's like dot dot, you know, like that. But he made this rap music album. And the president And I guess the trustees were very upset. They said, this is not the image of Harvard University. Harvard is known for being sober and, you know, conservative, and you are representing our entire university. You are a professor, you're on the faculty. He said, you have compromised the dignity of this whole college by making a rap record. And Cornel West said, he basically told the president, said, you're an illusion. He said, you are in illusion. He said, what is the use of knowledge if it's not relevant to the people? He said, okay, college, Harvard University is one thing, but don't you know that the majority of Americans living in the ghettos and in middle class, and these people desperately need knowledge. I was giving knowledge. I was giving values in my rap record. It's a language that the people of the lower classes of America, and even the middle classes, so many, they relate to it. They'll listen to it. They're not going to come and listen to your lectures, but they'll listen to my rap albums. And what is a purpose of education? It's to change hearts. It's to raise people consciousness. Don't you get it? And he said, you're not allowed to do this anymore. And Cornel West resigned. He said, I won't, if you're trying to restrict me, I will not be a part of Harvard University. And then Princeton called him and said, we heard you resigned. We don't mind if you make rap records, come to Princeton. So now he's at Princeton. So I don't know why I told that story, but you know, we have to present spiritual truth in a way that's relevant to our children at the time. And they're scientific minded now, they're philosophically minded now, and they're practical. How is actually this going to make a difference in the world and in my life? And I think because they're asking those questions, they could go much higher and deeper if they just get relevant answers. So we should see the potential of hope even in these apparently hopeless situations. Chitaraj, would you like to give a commentary on that?
You just said something which you actually asked me a question at the right time. Like you said, in their language, ISKCON has a band of youth people called Enchanters, and these are all very young college people, and they're fully into spiritualism, and they have a band. So it's their language, but they're still speaking spiritualism, and with such panache. Really.
And for the rest of us, what do you do?
I work as a radio jockey. There's a radio station in Mumbai called Radio Mirchi, owned by the Times of India Group of Publications. And incidentally, we had the honor of launching the book of Swamiji. So I feel very, very proud.
And yeah, he's very, very, very popular with the generation I just
discovered. We're going to have this band on our show tomorrow morning again because they're doing a youth festival in Mumbai tomorrow. And they're all on my show tomorrow morning.
Incidentally, their son is a fabulous musician.
Yeah.
He's a natural musician.
Okay.
He's in 11th grade. Or 12th grade now? Yes. 12. 12. Sorry, I'm out here.
So what time is it there?
7 to 11. Wake them up and take them to offices, take them to their colleges. Swamiji was there on that show.
Your studio is like a holy place. Thank you. Would anyone else like to share anything? Which childhood friend? No, actually what happened is we were good. You know how when you're growing up, usually you have all different phases of friends? At least that's the way most people, you know, when I was 7, I had certain friends, and then when I was 10, I kind of, some other friends, because your interests kind of change, even though you're all living within the same few minutes of each other. So you're always friends, but you're kind of with people who, as you develop special interests, those people who have common interests. So through high school graduation, we were friendly, but I wasn't really strong friends with them beyond about 10. And then when I took that summer vacation in 1970 between college semesters, and I never came back. While I was away, my parents sold the house and moved. So the only friend I ever met again that I had when I was young was Gary, the one I went on the trip with. And even he, 17 years, we had no idea where each other were. Somehow, by God's grace, we just ran into each other. So I don't know where he is. He might be a rabbi in a synagogue just to revolt against his parents. Americans could be like that. Something like that. I'm so honored, Counselor General of the United States of America. His good wife are here. It's really an honor. You are in the city of Bombay and Maharashtra, in this whole section, western section of India, you're representing the United States of America. And such a wonderful representation. Anyone who meets you will love America. As soon as I met Peter and Amy, I wanted to say pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. Please, please.
This will work well. Your comment about we are all part of the, we are all human, we are all living, we are all parts of the same body. We have the very interesting experience of now representing the U.S. here. Peter is Consul General, and I am just his wife. And your comments about the head is not superior to the kidney or to the leg or to the foot. And we have to spend a lot of time laughing and marveling because, as I put it, we both are the same nobodies that we were in Jakarta 8 months ago, who no one was particularly interested in meeting or getting to know. And now, I'm afraid we are the head and the brains, the Consul General, and everything is different. People treat us differently. And we go home from events and we just shake our heads and we laugh a little bit. And is it just human nature that, I mean, is this hopeless that we really will all understand that the janitor at the American school is the same as Craig, is the same as, I just don't know what to do with this. We're still not quite sure how to.
Just be who you are and what you are, and if what you're saying is actually beautiful. When people honor us for our position, it's very dangerous to take it seriously. It's very safe to laugh about it. Because really, who are we? You know, there was a great king named Prataparudra, and he was the king of Orissa. This is 5 centuries back. He had a massive empire, armies, undisputed king. And he would go out and sweep the street in front of Lord Jagannath, because he wanted to, that was really just who he was. I'm just like everybody else, but my role is to do this now. He performed his duties very, very responsibly, but ultimately we're all children of God. In our tradition, Lord Chaitanya taught that whoever we are, we should never think we're anything but the servant of the servant of the servant of the Lord. That means to serve everyone, whether we're king or whether we're ambassadors or whether we're council generals or whether we're bank heads or whether we're radio jockeys or whether we're swamis or whether we're housewives or whether we're in charge of schools. We're all just servants of the servants, and we're performing our roles in ways that we can best serve. So it's really nice that you laugh about it, because really that means you're just down to earth. And the leaders in the world should be down to earth. Because right now you're actually put in positions as actually very influential leaders of the world. Being a counselor general for the United States of America, you're a world leader now. And world leaders should have a sense of humor about their position. To be responsible, to be exemplary, but to understand that I'm just like everybody else, and this is what my service is. You know, whether I'm serving as the toe or whether I'm serving as the heart. You know, the heart needs the toe and the toe needs the heart. We're all together. So I think it's very beautiful. You know, I'm a swami, but you know, people bow down to me, but all I could do is laugh. You know, you're getting invited to these very prestigious events as chief guests of honor. But at least you've had a bank account and signed checks. Who am I? So that's good. We're all brothers and sisters in that spirit, and I'm deeply impressed by your humble spirit. The world really needs leaders like you. Thank you. It's really what the foundation of the American spirit is, that the leaders are meant to be the actual servants of the people. It's not the way it always is, but if the people vote you in, or somebody appoints you who's been voted in, then you know we're meant to really just be the selfless servants of the people, willing to make sacrifices for the people. We shouldn't be attached to the position, we should be attached to the service, whatever it may be. So keep laughing. Like to say, Peter, would you like to say anything?
A couple of days ago, I participated in the intercivilizational dialogue and discussing multiculturalism, and various groups living together, and there was discussion about melting pot in the United States with the notion of homogenization of people. There was also discussion of the tossed salad approach, where each different group maintained its own identity, but was in a salad mixed together, all contributing to something. But what I've enjoyed this evening is hearing the metaphor of the garland, and the thread that goes through it, because the mixed salad approach has more of a sense of chaos and just being jumbled together, whereas the garland has this sense of unity and something that goes through. And then I'd also like to thank Vivek, who in many ways tonight was our thread for this garland. And so I really appreciate the opportunity that he's given to me and to Amy and to probably some other people here to hear these ideas to which we haven't really been exposed to. And so thank you very much, Vivek, and also and thank you to you for sharing this evening.
Thank you. To be honest, they happened to give me this garland, so I gave the analogy. If his son would have given me a salad, I probably would have ended up given the salad analogy. So all credit goes to the big son for that one. Thank you very much. Greg, anything you'd like to speak?
I don't think there's anything I could add right now. It's been a lovely evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
We have a couple of people who joined us later, Neeraj and Sunita. And I'm meeting after. Muge is from Turkey.
From Turkey,
yeah.
Amazing.
I had the honor to run a business in Turkey and have the hospitality of famous, the beautiful Turkish people. And now there's a Turkish person running a business in India.
Is that her?
It's her. She's running a very large part of Citibank's business in India. And I ran a large part of the Turkish business as an Indian.
Citibank? Same?
And so this is the world, you know? And I could never imagine a Turkish person running an Indian business. And I doubt a Turkish person at that time imagined an Indian person running a Turkish business, right? So it's just fascinating. And we have Sonia there. And her husband is there, so we'll introduce people. Vasu is our consul general from Malaysia, of Indian origin.
Yes, yeah.
And I guess we get a chance to chat up as we just break out for dinner.
Very honored.
I'm extremely grateful, as we all are, that Swami Radhanath made time. His schedule is amazing. And I saw him at the Rath Yatra, and you know, he has a personal touch that's amazing. I was in this crowd of maybe 200,000 people, and Swamiji was on stage. And I, like a nice Indian, when he was coming downstage, went so that he could get to see me, and I could say hello. And then we exchanged garlands, and I said, I'd like to visit you at the temple. He said, can we do a program at home? And here we are within a week. I'll share with you a little incident, you know, 10 seconds on this. And we were trying to get dates. I thought we could get Peter and Craig and the American school people together, some of them. And I didn't know what date works. So we got two dates from his diary, with 20th and 27th. And I circulated it around to Peter and said, what date suits you? And he came back to me at 6 in the evening on a particular date and said, 20th works for me and Amy. So I said, okay, now what do I do to, how do I fix his date? Now I got one date, right? That's a moving target. And while I was thinking of what to do, within 2 hours, I get a message from
the temple, that the date that actually works for us is 20th. I said, all right, so I didn't do a thing. You know, it's so here we are. I just thought we could have a different evening. And I know Swamiji is addressing universities globally, addressing global corporations, and more importantly, inspiring people to lead a purer spiritual life. I'm deeply honored that you all came and Maharaj is here. And we will partake the food of his own temple food here tonight, if we can. And those of you, while we do that, who haven't met Maharaj and you came in a little late, why don't you can meet him and have a small chat with him? With your permission, Maharaj, can we?
Please. Thank you so much.